The chief judges and the judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome. It's a real pleasure to have all of you here today. I'm pleased to announce that we have a bar admission ceremony this morning, so we'll begin with that. At this time, the court recognizes Mr. Robert Monahan for a motion.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I move the admission of Ty Christian of the state of Florida, Casey Connolly of the state of New Hampshire, Meredith Donaldson of the state of Wisconsin, Titus Hatton of the state of Nebraska, Mark Hendel of the state of Vermont, Ryan Kincaid of the state of Texas, Eric Marshall of the state of California, and Eric Amara of the state of California. I have examined the credentials of these candidates, which are on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied that they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of this court, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and legal acumen. Accordingly, we have voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of the court. Therefore, Mr. Monahan, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath.
Please stand and raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support the Constitution of the United States and that you will conduct yourselves as attorneys and counselors of this court uprightly and according to the law, so help you God?
I do.
Counsel, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of the court. In doing so, I believe it's appropriate for me to recite the aspirational words of the law school I attended and which Judge Johnson received her LLM from. That's the University of Virginia School of Law. And those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because each one of you exemplifies those ideals, it is an honor indeed to admit you to the bar of this court. So congratulations. Thank you, Mr. Monahan. Do we have any other business to attend to before we turn to oral argument?
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Then we will call our first case. Our case today is United States versus Kigo. Lieutenant Colonel Neely, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Blair, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Chief Judge.
Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Olson, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Neely, and I represent appellant Midshipman Kigo. I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Granted.
Wadir, meaning to speak the truth, is how we assess members' potential partiality. The truth about Lieutenant Commander Charlie is he thinks that an innocent person will testify, and an accused failure to testify will come to mind during deliberations. Lieutenant Commander Charlie struggles to presume innocence. The truth about Lieutenant Sierra is observing his wife's emotional journey as a rape survivor has had a huge impact on him, a heartbreaking. And the truth about Lieutenant Commander Mike is the government had no argument against her partiality because she wants to believe victims and cannot imagine a reasonable person mistaking consent in a one-night stand. The truth is, these members may claim to be fair, but they are not impartial. An objective member of the public would question the fairness of having them sit on appellant's panel. I'd like to address each of these three members in turn and why the military judge abused his discretion.
So when you say abused his discretion, is that the actual standard we should be applying here?
Yes, Your Honor. For actual bias, the judge receives if he abuses his discretion. And for implied bias, it's something less than de novo review, but something more than an abuse of discretion.
So with implied bias, what exactly does that mean? We all know what we're dealing with when we're talking about abuse of discretion or when we're talking about de novo. What is this hybrid standard that we on this court should be applying when we're reviewing the military judge's decision?
Your Honor, this court should take a look at whether an objective member of the public, informed of all the circumstances, the totality of these circumstances, would question the fairness of these members sitting on appellate's panel, both on the merits and in sentencing.
Can I just make sure, is everybody able to hear counsel? Okay, please proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. So here, Lieutenant Commander Charlie, the totality of his circumstances include him saying 9 times that an innocent person should testify, a belief that was so ingrained that he explicitly agreed, without reservation or qualification, that an innocent person would testify to show him that they were innocent. He made 7 statements showing that he could not correctly apply the presumption of innocence, and the totality of his circumstances also included him having, as he describes, an indelible experience with his mother over a series of conversations about an attempted rape. This experience, as he says, could not be removed, could not be washed away from how he views the world. And if any one of these things creates an actual bias, but if not an actual bias, the totality of these circumstances certainly creates an objective appearance of unfairness. And the liberal grant mandate demands that Lieutenant Commander Charlie should have been excused from the panel.
I want to ask a question about the liberal grant mandate. As an appellate reviewing court, I understand what we've said in our directions to the military judge, but as an appellate court reviewing what the military judge did, how do we think about the liberal grant mandate? Because it seems like we have ordered the military judges in close cases to grant the challenges. So I guess my first question would be, who gets to make the determination of what is and what is not a close case? And is that a factual determination, or is that a legal determination?
Your Honor, I think that appellate courts also need to consider it, because the reason that it exists is to protect the perception of fairness in military justice. And so just because the military judge gets it wrong doesn't remove the opportunity from the appellate courts to also protect the perception of fairness in military justice.
Right, but we review lots of things, and some we give tremendous deference to the military judges because they're factual questions, and then we give no deference for legal questions. Is whether or not this was a close case, is that a legal determination, or is that a factual determination?
I believe it's a legal determination, Your Honor, admitting that it could have some factual elements to it. However, because it is closer to a de novo review, I believe it is a legal determination. Here, the military judge didn't even acknowledge that this was a close case, and it clearly is at least a close case, if not an obvious case for implied bias or actual bias. And his failure to adequately address this is reason for this court to find an abuse of discretion in and of itself.
I mean, if what you just said was true, that it whether or not it's a close case is a legal determination that deserves no deference, and if we believe it was a close case, is that the end of the analysis, right? That's just, if we have mandated that the military judges in closed cases must grant challenges, and then we believe that it is a closed case, is that how the liberal mandate works? Is it over at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. If it is a closed case, the liberal grant mandate must be applied, and so it should be over at that point. The military judge didn't explain in his ruling why it wasn't a closed case in his mind. He didn't explain why an objective member of the public wouldn't consider the totality of these circumstances as questioning the fairness of the panel. And this court has held before in Peters and Downing that that is an abuse of discretion.
Lieutenant Colonel Neely, would it change? I'm sorry, I wasn't sure the mic was on. Would it change? You said that who makes the determination of whether it's a close case? You said that you thought it was a legal determination. But would your analysis change if it was a factual determination? He made a factual finding that Lieutenant Commander C had been rehabilitated.
No, Your Honor, it wouldn't change my analysis. If it's a close case, first of all, I think it is a legal determination, but even if he made the factual determination that he had been rehabilitated, that doesn't absolve the appellate court's responsibility to make a determination on their own.
Okay.
Military judge here also found facts that weren't supported by the record. The Lieutenant Commander Charlie twice said that the appellant's failure to testify, quote, will come to mind. Yet the military judge said that Lieutenant Commander Charlie might think about it. Lieutenant Commander Charlie also thought that because there are charges something, or excuse me, the military judge said that because Lieutenant Commander Charlie thought there were charges something, quote, may have happened, when in fact Lieutenant Commander Charlie said something had to have happened. And finally, the military judge failed in his duty to inquire further into the indelible nature of the conversations with his mother. And the military judge said, it's not clear from voir dire, end quote, that this is something that might have had an impact. Alarm bells should have been going off in the military judge's head that he had a duty to inquire further into that as he was making this ruling. Turning to Lieutenant Commander Mike, who the government had no argument against her partiality. Lieutenant Commander Mike made six statements showing that consent is not affirmatively stated, she's unable to impartially consider the mistake of fact offense. She needs a clear expression of consent in a one-night stand. And absent that, she cannot find a reasonable person mistaking consent. She also said three times she is partial to believing a victim over disbelieving a victim. The totality of these circumstances create an objective appearance of unfairness, again, in Lieutenant Commander Mike's circumstances, and the liberal grant mandate should have been applied to excuse her. The military judge not only failed to correctly apply the liberal grant mandate, but he abused his discretion in two other ways. First, the trial defense counsel explicitly challenged her over the belief over disbelief comments, and yet the military judge failed to put his reasoning on the record as to why that wasn't either an actual or implied bias. Because he didn't put his reasoning on the record, he deserves no deference. He also made a clearly erroneous finding of fact that Lieutenant Commander Mike said the clear yes should be taken in a training context, when the record clearly shows that she wasn't talking about this in a training context. She was talking about this in a one-night stand or a monogamous relationship.
But was it clear from the record that she was talking about, she was giving those answers about belief over disbelief in a court-martial context, in a trial context, as compared to a societal context?
Yes, Your Honor. So she begins the conversation of belief over disbelief. She begins it first by saying investigation, but then she carries that further. She says, quote, in a court of law, end quote, she needs to be hearing testimony, and then equates that to believing over disbelieving, or in other words, not demonizing or putting the accuser on trial. So she was clearly discussing this in the context of a court-martial as a broader, in addition to the broader circumstances of cultural pressures. The military judge abused his discretion in failing to dismiss Lieutenant Sierra, where his role was his wife's emotional support provider through her journey as a rape survivor. This experience left him understanding how traumatic that journey can be. It was a huge impact on him. He described it as heartbreaking. And then Lieutenant Sierra finds himself on a panel that he describes as to fix the problem. As in Terry Miles, an objective observer would doubt the fairness of the accused court-martial panel on sentencing. Military judge abuses discretion. Again, the trial defense counsel specifically challenged on an implied bias basis Lieutenant Sierra's presence on the panel because of his wife's experience. The military judge only said, as to punishment, the court believes that Lieutenant Sierra's answer that he would be willing to consider the full range of punishments was sufficient. This frames the problem, but it doesn't squarely address it. Again, he failed to put his analysis on the record about why this isn't a close call, about why an objective member of the public wouldn't question the fairness on sentence. That is an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, I don't think anyone's going to object to your assertion that questionable statements were made either on the questionnaires or during voir dire. But I don't think this court has ever held that is just per se grounds for dismissing someone if the military judge thinks that their subsequent answers or their other answers or in the totality of the circumstances of everything they say is sufficient to rehabilitate them. Now, why, I mean, this is not a situation where the military judge denied all of the challenges. He granted six challenges. So, I mean, that seems to suggest he was thinking about whether or not these people had been sufficiently rehabilitated if they said concerning things. Why shouldn't we give deference to the military judge's analysis that he seems to have, you know, he seems to have given thought to each one of the individual panel members and thought about whether or not in the totality of the circumstances, all the good answers they gave, plus all the questionable answers they gave, why they weren't, they couldn't sit on the panel.
Yes, Your Honor, two things. First, although the military judge did correctly state the law, the record and those other challenges actually reveals, or gives a clear signal that he wasn't correctly applying it. On page 496 of the joint appendix, he did dismiss Lieutenant Mike, and he said because Lieutenant Mike wouldn't follow the military judge's discretion and therefore or instructions, and therefore, as a matter of implied bias, he was excused. But that's an actual bias test, whether or not a member will yield to the military judge's instructions. Second, yes, these members did make rehabilitative answers, but then they returned to their problematic answers. And they're repeatedly returning to their problematic answers reveals this ingrained bias. And that is the difference here. The last thing, for example, Lieutenant Commander Charlie said was that he needed to hear an innocent accused testify to show his innocence. He agreed to that. That was never rehabilitated. He continued to return to these problematic answers. And the rehabilitative answers were largely predictable answers from leading questions, which Nash reminds us is not effective rehabilitation. And finally, when there is so
but
much...
But how do we decide that? You know, obviously your point, I think, is that as the proceeding goes forward, it is evident to a potential panel member what the trial counsel or what the military judge is looking for in terms of an answer. But how do we at the appellate level delve beyond that to say, you know what, they were really having words and ideas put into their mouths and into their brains. They were simply following the cues that were being provided to them rather than sincerely having been rehabilitated.
Yes, Your Honor. Two things. First is this: the premise of this question suggests that it's a close call, and the liberal grant mandate answers that for us. If it is a close call and we're struggling with it, then the member should be excused. And the military judge at the trial level has an obligation at the outset to weed out these biases.
Let's say you've got someone on a panel who has no connection with military justice or justice at all, and they, for whatever reason, happen to believe that the burden is on an accused to prove themselves innocent. And then it is pointed out to them, that's not the standard at all. Will you follow the military judge's instructions? And the potential panel member says, yes.
Yes, sir.
So why wouldn't that be sufficient?
In that case, where that is the only issue revealing some sort of bias or impartiality, I think the totality of those circumstances would be appropriate. However, with these three members, it's not just one issue. It's a whole list of issues. And so this court has to consider the totality of all those issues together when making this determination.
Counsel, sorry.
I think it's on.
Sure. Is it on? Counsel, could you address the position of the amicus brief by the National Institute of Military Justice, how we should reconceptualize RCM 912 and move away from actual implied bias, but look at each one of the disqualifying factors and apply a separate standard review to each one of them?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have to confess that I wasn't given a copy of that amicus brief, so I can't address that question. The truth about these three members is Lieutenant Commander Charlie and Lieutenant Sierra were both personally impacted by sexual violence in a way that they could not wash or remove from the way they view the world. Lieutenant Commander Mike, who is charged with judging the credibility of these witnesses, chooses to believe accusers over disbelieving them. And no member of the public would perceive these three members on appellant's panel as fair. This court should set aside the findings and sentence, and pending any other questions, respectfully request reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Any further questions? Thank you. Captain Blair.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Captain Tyler Blair, and along with Colonel Joseph Jennings, I represent the United States. This court should affirm appellant's convictions for three reasons. First, this court should defer to the military judge. Second, no member had any actual bias. And third, no member had any implied bias. To the first point, this court should defer to the military judge as he correctly stated the law. He considered the defense challenges for actual and implied bias. He observed the members. He put his reasoning on the record, including his observations of their demeanor and their reactions, and he applied the liberal grant mandate.
Did he put his implied bias analysis on the record, or did he treat implied bias as sort of actual bias light? Like, did he ever talk about public perception or any of the other factors that go into the implied bias analysis, or did he just really focus on actual bias and then dismiss the implied bias charges at the end in a sort of conclusory fashion?
Judge Hardy, the military judge correctly laid out the standard for implied bias, and then putting his reasoning on the record, he correctly considered the implied bias challenges. And while he may not have repeated the law every time that he decided an implied bias challenge, he still correctly stated the standard and then addressed the actual bias challenges and the implied bias challenges from the perspective of a reasonably informed member of the public.
Did that phrase ever come out of his mouth other than when he stated the law at the beginning?
Yes, Your Honor. And then definitely as far as substantial doubt. And when looking at this court's precedent, specifically Downing or Daugherty, this court doesn't require record dissertations, but merely indications.
But it certainly affects the level of deference, right? The Chief mentioned earlier we have the sliding scale between abuse of discretion and de novo review, and where we fall on that scale is based in part on the extent of the analysis for implied bias that the military judge puts on the record. And when I look at his rulings, it seems like he gives a lot of explanation why he's denying the actual bias challenges, but I don't see any analysis specific to implied bias. But you're right, he stated the law correctly at the beginning. But after that point, I don't see that he ever circled back to explain why he was denying the implied bias challenges. Am I wrong? Did I miss it?
Your Honor, even if the military judge didn't go into great detail or expound on how the public's perception would be, or if there'd be substantial doubt, he still follows the other requisite parts and deserves deference on those points when it comes to implied bias, which is a purely legal test. And going back to your earlier question as far as how to consider the liberal grant mandate and how this court should deal with that, in previous cases, this court has looked at applying the liberal grant mandate to actual bias, which is bias in fact, which would be concerning a matter of fact, and then implied bias, which would be a matter of law. So depending on where this court applies the liberal grant mandate, whether it's for an actual bias or implied bias, it'd be a question of law or a question of fact, and then put together a mixed question of law or fact, whether it's a close case. And this court has disagreed with military judges in the past about whether a case has been a close case or not.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that anyway. So I asked the appellant, I think you should have the opportunity to answer the question, who gets to decide whether or not it's a close case?
This court does, Your Honor, when reviewing the case.
And is that a legal question or is that a factual question?
And as I said, Your Honor, Judge Hardy, I mean, it's when it's looking at implied bias, it's a question of law, but facts also matter as well. And the military judge's determinations of credibility and their emotional reactions can go to matters of implied bias as well, and then actual bias is purely a matter of fact. Can the member follow the military judge's instructions, and can they put aside their bias and fairly judge Pellett's case?
But so I'm, you know, when I read your brief and I went through the when you set out the law and the standard of review, the only time you mentioned the liberal grant mandate was that you mentioned that we have said, and you're right about this, that if the military judge mentions it, they are entitled to more deference. And certainly here, the military judge mentioned it. He mentioned it many, many times. He frequently cited it when he was granting or denying challenges. So in this case, he gets deference because he was aware of and applied the liberal grant mandate. I think that's fair. But the determination of whether or not this was a close case, for at least for the implied bias challenges, you agree with your colleague that that is, in the implied bias context, that's a legal question that we can decide de novo.
No, Your Honor. This court has said time and again that it's the standard review for implied bias is slightly less deferential than abuse of discretion, but more deferential than de novo.
Well, it depends. It's a sliding scale. But what I think our cases don't answer is, what do we do as an appellate court sitting in review with the liberal grant mandate? We've put this mandate out there, this order to the military judges, in a close case, you must grant, right? That's what we've said. And so I'm trying to decide, well, who gets, we never clarified, at least I don't think we've ever clarified, as sitting as an appellate court, or if the CCAs are reviewing it, who gets to decide, right? I think it's fair to imply from the military judge's ruling that he didn't think these were closed cases. Because he cites the liberal grant mandate and says even applying it, he's still not granting the implied bias challenges. So he has made a determination that these are, with respect to these three panel members, these are not closed cases. Is that a factual finding that he gets deference on, that we would only overturn if he was clearly erroneous? Or is that a legal determination that we review de novo? And I don't think the answer is in our precedent. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But what is your answer?
First, Judge Hardy, I think it's a reasonable inference from the record when the judge says he's considering the liberal grant mandate that he is considered whether it's a closed case or not and decided it's not. Second, to your question about how to handle this issue, how this court should look at it, I think it is a mixed question of law and fact, because the liberal grant mandate does encompass both actual and implied bias challenges. How much deference this court gives to that determination, I think this court also has to take into account the other factors that this court looks to in granting deference to the military judge, whether any of his other factual findings that he relies on his ruling were clearly erroneous, or if he in any way misstated the law or appears to have misapplied the law. And we have, for all these challenges, the military judge does not. And a helpful case may be Rogers, where this court looked to what this court decided was a close case and then ultimately came down and not in reviewing the implied bias challenge de novo, because the military judge failed to put the full law on the record and failed to put his full reasoning on the record. That's different from this case, because the judge was thoughtful in putting down his reasoning for all of the nearly two dozen members that he had to deal with during voir dire. And he put his reasoning on the record. He applied the correct law, considered the liberal grant mandate, and he deserves deference.
How do we distinguish Peters? Because I think this case, there are aspects of this case that are very similar to Peters. In Peters, the military judge stated that he was applying the liberal grant mandate, but then didn't put a tremendous amount of explanation of the implied bias test onto the record, and the court decided it was a closed case and did overturn the military judge. So how do we distinguish Peters?
In your honor, I think, again, this is distinguishable from Peters the same way it is from Rogers, is the military judge in that case didn't put his reasoning on the record. And if this court finds there is an instance where the military judge doesn't fully put his reasoning on the record of certain instances, he would receive less deference for that specific instance. But if this court looks at all these individual instances for each of these members, while taking totality of the circumstances, you have to look at each individual aspect, and you can find from looking at the record that these members don't have actual or implied bias. And going back to...
Are any of these three panel members, Lieutenant Commander Charlie or Lieutenant Commander Mike or Lieutenant Sierra, are any of these close cases? For implied bias, not for actual bias.
No, Your Honor.
If with respect to Lieutenant Commander Mike, if this was not a close case, why didn't the government present any argument in response to defense counsel's argument, defense counsel's challenge? It's hard to interpret what the government did there. It looks like they had no objection to a motion essentially being presented by defense counsel.
That's one way to look at it, Your Honor, but the record isn't clear. This court's case in Strand, where the government didn't make any objection, this court ultimately looked to whether the military judge deserved deference and the military judge's duty to rule on the challenge, not whether or not the government's actions.
But if you're a military judge, how are you to interpret when you've got the motion made by the accused counsel and the government says, no argument? Doesn't that mean, for all intents and purposes, that the government understood that there was a basis for having that potential panel member removed?
That's one inference, Chief Judge, but...
So how do we decide which inference we should give credit to?
And Chief Judge, I would say that this court doesn't have to go to make any kind of factual determination, but rather can look to the military judge's sua sponte duty to make rulings on these issues and look at his rulings, whether he deserves deference, whether his statements on the law and his factual findings were correct.
But part of the issue then is what we're looking at with implied bias is, through the eyes of the public, their perception of fairness. You've got a couple instances here where one potential prospective panel member saying that his wife previously had been raped. You've got another prospective panel member says his mother, there was an attempted rape of her that left an indelible impression. You've got a situation where the government in this, when there's a motion made, is saying no argument. How do we look at that and say, well, the hypothetical public would not have a concern about the fairness of having these prospective panel members sit on this panel?
Chief Judge, a fully informed member of the public would not have a substantial doubt as to the fairness of appellant's panel, and demonstrated by going through the record one by one. And I think...
Can I just ask, in terms of the totality of the circumstances, and also when you're saying fully informed, would the fully informed panel member member of the public realize that accused counsel only had one peremptory challenge, that there are only 8 panel members, not 12, that it's not a unanimous decision, there's only 3/4 vote that's required, and then you have these problems with these prospective panel members? Is that part of the totality of the circumstances? Is that what a fully informed member of the public looking at this and saying, do I feel this is fair? Having them sit on this panel, is that what they would be considering, all of that?
I think that's a fair characterization, Chief Judge, because it's an objective test of a member of the public fully informed of how the military justice system works. So those would be things that would be considered. But I think you really going, and I think appellant slightly mischaracterizes the record when going into details from the record for each of these specific members. And starting with Commander Charlie talking about his mother, these are not the same crimes in any ways. As you talk about, Chief Judge, this is an attempted rape regarded from a kidnapping where this mother was rescued from police. It's not the same as the member said himself during general voir dire, that if any member of his family had suffered a similar offense, he said no. Again, looking at Castillo, there was no implied bias for a member who was a victim of sexual assault. It only happened decades before, less amount of time than this member related to his mother, which he only found out about decades later. He said he could fairly and partially decide the case. He didn't think they were similar, and he said he could fairly apply the military judge instructions and applicable law, and that he had no bias. And while normally that goes towards actual bias, this court has found that strong statements, unequivocal statements, that they could apply military judge's instructions and had no bias, could go towards implied bias as well. So going back to actual bias, no member on this case, all members on this on the panel, these three members specifically, said they could follow the military judge's instructions and said that they would be fair and impartial in deciding the appellant's case. And that also factors into deference warranted to the military judge, because when, as this court said in Clay, when there are no actual biases found, a finding of implied bias will be rare. And I think that also circles back to the liberal grant mandate. Whether it's a close case, if there's no actual bias, it also factors into whether there's implied bias. So going and looking at these implied bias instances one by one, for Commander Mike, regarding consent, her discussion of consent on the record shows a good amount of nuance. As this court has said in Woods, voir dire is not a civics exam. You don't expect members to come in and have a perfect understanding of the law. And all these members demonstrated an openness to following the military judge's instructions.
Is that true with Lieutenant Commander Mike? I mean, I think the appellant raised a mistake of fact defense, right? That's an affirmative defense that was at issue in this case. And I don't see anywhere in the record where Lieutenant Commander Mike actually affirmatively agreed that that was a viable defense. She started out, I think, stating that she couldn't think of, I don't think she ever, and maybe you could point me to her best statement on the record where she agreed that there could be a mistake of fact as to consent in an alleged sexual assault.
Judge Hardy, at page 386 of the record, Lieutenant Commander Mike talks about consent is very hard to prove one way or the other, and that's why it becomes sometimes a he said, she said thing. And when asked, when Lieutenant Commander Mike was asked whether she could think of something off the top of her head, she didn't say, no, that can't happen. She said, no, she couldn't think of one when she was under oath and in the proceeding of a court-martial. Doesn't mean she was closed off to the idea. It means she just couldn't think of one.
So, I mean, that's the best statement you can find in the record to prove or support your assertion that she had an open mind about whether or not there could be a mistake of fact as to consent, is to her statement that she couldn't think of any circumstance where that would actually happen.
No, Judge Hardy. The best statement I can point to is her nuanced view on 386 of the record that consent is a difficult thing and it's not easy to prove one way or the other. I was merely explaining the other aspect.
Captain Blair, are you also coupled with her nuanced statements, are you also bootstrapping the lack of bias based upon her statement that she could follow the military judge's instructions and the fact that the military judge did in fact instruct and instructed on consent?
Yes, Judge Johnson. At 519 of the record, the military judge correctly instructed Commander Mike about consent, which would be different from the member in Rogers, who was never instructed, who had an incorrect belief, but Commander Mike never had an incorrect belief about the idea of consent. She simply could not give the correct legal definition. We don't expect that of members.
Counsel, one of the things that's difficult about our case, our precedents in this, is that we don't have the records, right? We don't really have excellent dissertation of the facts of those cases. And sometimes the cases refer to curative measures taken by the military judge, and I take that to mean the military judge interrupted and corrected something they thought was a misperception or a misunderstanding on the part of the panel member. And then we have just the standard boilerplate jury instructions that get given later, right? Things about, you know, burden of proof and evidence and things like that. If I review the record correctly, here the military judge never did the former, never had a curative measure with these three They never intervened to correct a misunderstanding or point something out, but he did give all the appropriate jury instructions. Should we look at those two things differently?
First, Judge Hardy, that's correct. The military judge never specifically intervened and gave a direct specific instruction or a curative instruction to members in this case. Second, to whether the military is required to, that's not in this court's case law, the requirement to do that. As discussed in Rogers, the military judge had the opportunity to correctly inform that member when that member, who was the president of the board, specifically asked the definition to a legal term. And the judge said, rely on your understanding, your layman's understanding of the term. And I see that I'm out of time, if I may.
Further questions? Any further questions from the bench?
No, Chief Judge, but I would like, if he was not finished answering the question, I'd like to hear the end of his answer.
Did you have more that you'd like to explain?
Yes, Chief Judge. Thank you, Judge Johnson. The judge in Rogers had the opportunity, as this court found, to correct that incorrect legal understanding. He wasn't required to do that during voir dire. It just needed to be corrected at some point, as this court talked about. And when given the opportunity, he didn't do it, and that member was left with the incorrect legal understanding of what competent was and what consent was. We don't have that issue here. This court should affirm appellant's convictions.
Any further questions? Thank you, Captain Blair. Lieutenant Colonel Neely.
Thank you. The appellant here is making an argument that they didn't make it, or excuse me, appellee is making an argument that they did not make at trial, that the military judge's decision to retain Lieutenant Commander Mike should be affirmed, even though he did not put on the record that why believing over disbelieving is not an actual or implied bias. This court should not accept that as proper, and this court should find that that is an abuse of discretion. This court has found more than once that rarely in closed cases is simply stating the correct legal standard enough to find that the military judge gets deference, and that's in Peters and in Downing. Military judge, this court also talked to Appelli about what the correct standard is. It's not just that a member of the public would question the fairness. It's if it's even a close call that the member of the public would question the fairness, then the members must be excused. And lastly, this court in Townsend wondered whether such extensive rehabilitation might in and of itself create the closed case where the liberal grant mandate required excluding a member. In this case, particularly for Lieutenant Commander Charlie, we have that. Military judge attempted to rehabilitate Lieutenant Commander Charlie over nearly two pages of record, and that is an extensive rehabilitation that in and of itself creates a question of fairness in the military justice system. Pending any questions, for those reasons, appellant requests.
I have a question. So the government's absolutely right that we have said many times over and over again that in the absence of actual bias, that successful implied bias challenges will be very rare. So given that, did you believe our cases in, say, Clay or Peters, have we ever really deviated from that standard?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has found occasion where the military judge didn't find actual bias. So Terry's an example, where they found that there was no actual bias, but then still excluded the member for implied bias. So this court has done that before, and this is a case where it's appropriate to do that again.
You would say that this is one of those exceedingly rare cases where that would be the case?
Yes, Your Honor. Given the amount of issues that each of these members have, the totality of those circumstances create the implied bias.
Any further questions? Thank you. Case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise.